that rock, rock is rock. I mean, it is or isn't. I mean, it's like the light is on a rock. See? And once you've gone over the line, you've established this rock is rock. And we evaluated two operations, two-thirds of the years.
I'll get this back to you, okay?
Oh, I forgot this reference too. Who gave me the reference? Did you give me the reference? Who gave me the key 3 network?
Oh, I think.
I forgot what the number is. April, I think it was the 6th. There was that interesting, I think it was Bernstein did a commentary on it just in the back of the tape, like Duke Day, but I'll call it 67. They say, well, the last moon was. But he went through the triad, though, which I thought back.
Okay, class, everybody take out a piece of paper. Clear your desk of everything but that piece of paper, please. Maybe Friday, but you're not going to get off that easy. This will show whether you read the reading assignment or not. Okay, put your name on the paper, first of all, so we can give credit where credit is due. Or lack of credit, as the case may be. No, I don't want it. I know you'll do real good on this, if you read the assignment. Now, this is a pop quiz, okay? So you can write pop quiz across the top. The date is, according to my watch, March 1st. Is that right? Oh, my watch doesn't know about leap year. That's the problem. All right. I haven't programmed it right. Put 229.80 then. So this is 1 in 4 years where we get an extra day in February, huh? How come all the girls aren't leaping for all the guys then? Or is this when the guys leap for the girls? I can't remember what it is. Now, you have the date, you have your name, you have pop quiz. Don't forget the class. This is Survey of Old Testament History. Now you say, oh, come on, teacher, this is so basic. Yeah, I know it's basic, but I get papers all the time that don't have the name, that don't have the class, that don't have the date, that don't have what it is. So this way, we'll have everything taken care of. Yes, you can abbreviate. Okay, ready? Question number one. You don't need to write the question down unless you want to, but do write the answer. So I'm going to give you 5 questions on this pop quiz, okay? And I'm just simply going to state them. By the way, if you're listening on tape, don't bother taking the pop quiz. You won't be marked down for it. You won't get credit for it. It won't be figured into your grade. Only those that are in this room will be required to take this test. Okay. How many silent years were there between Genesis and Exodus? The figure that was given in the book. There was a figure given in the book. How many silent years between Genesis and Exodus? Number two, how long did Israel stay in Egypt? I need a figure in years. How many years did Israel stay in Egypt? Number three, I wonder if anybody's written anything down yet. If I wait for that, we might be here all day. Number three, how long did Moses spend on the Sinai Peninsula? How long did Moses, he was alone, how long did Moses spend on the Sinai Peninsula? Number four, what was the 10th plague that God brought on Egypt? The 10th plague that God brought on Egypt. Last question, number five. According to 1 Kings 6:1, the Exodus occurred 480 years before what event? According to 1 Kings 6:1, the Exodus occurred 480 years before a certain event. What was that event? Anybody need a question repeated? Just going to give you another couple minutes. It's kind of the questions that you either know me or you don't really. It's kind of hard to fake it, you know, on these kind of questions. So we really don't need to give you another 10 minutes on the test. But I will repeat any of the questions if you need them repeated. So raise your hand. Yes. Number five. According to 1 Kings 6:1, the Exodus occurred 480 years before a certain event. What was that event? Name that event. Any others that anybody needs to have repeated? Okay, give you another minute to sit in perplexity or confidence, as the case may be, and then we're going to have you exchange your papers. Thank you. Okay, please exchange your papers. Please write your name on the paper as corrector, if you will. Use a different colored ink than what their paper is written in. And if you don't have an extra pen, raise your hand and some friend near you will help you with that, hopefully. And then make a mental note to bring an extra pen from now on so that you can correct tests in classes. Okay, now we have five questions. So each question will be worth 20 points, giving us a total of 100 points on the test, okay? Now, if the question is correct, leave it alone. Don't touch it. If it's wrong, you write in the correct answer in a different colored ink and then put minus 20 in the margin next to that number. Okay? Then we start with number one. How many silent years between Genesis and Exodus? Who knows? Yes?
I think it's like 300 to 400.
350 years. I can't accept any variations, otherwise I open a can of worms that I'll never close again. So we're going to have to be firm on that. 350 years or bust. Of course, what that's referring to is the fact that when you leave off in the book of Genesis, Jacob has just died and then Joseph died and they're down there in Egypt. And when you begin with the book of Exodus, 350 years approximately have passed and they're just about ready to come out of Egypt after all of that period there that's relatively silent. The Bible says little, if anything, about it. All right, number two. So that's 20 points each then. How long did Israel stay in Egypt? The answer here is 430 years. Again, it's all or nothing on it. No partial credit for closeness, but just 430 years or nothing. Yes? No. 430 years. That's where I'll draw the line. Makes it real easy that way. Otherwise, it's, well, within 5 years, it's minus 1 point. Within 10 years, it's minus 5 points, you know, and it just gets to be a big mess. If you read the article and you remembered it, then you got it. That's no problem there. Number three, how long, so 430 for number two, how long did Moses spend on the Sinai Peninsula? 40 years. 40 years. This was after he fled Egypt at the age of 40, after having killed an Egyptian and cast in his lot with his Hebrew brethren. He had to flee for his life, and he spent time in the Sinai wilderness for some 40 years before God sent him back in to deliver Israel. 40 years. Number four, what was the 10th plague on Egypt? The 10th plague was the death of the firstborn. Death on the firstborn. Okay? Number five, according to 1 Kings 6:1, the Exodus occurred 480 years before what event? Before the dedication of Solomon's temple. 480 years before the dedication of Solomon's temple, according to this verse, Israel came out of Egypt in the Exodus. So there's a chronological date. There's a time given in the Bible there. Yes?
How about building of Solomon's temple?
Okay, I will accept building of Solomon's temple. I'll give it full credit. Yes? Okay, that would be incorrect because it was the killing of all the firstborn. And I believe it was whether they were male or female. It was the killing of all the firstborn. In other words, anybody who was a firstborn in Egypt, in fact, probably not even limited to the newborn. In other words, let's say I was the firstborn in my family. I could be 30 years old, and the scripture seems to be saying that I would die as well, not just the infants. Now, that can't really be proved, but it's still wrong because it's not just the males, it's male and female. So I would say killing of all the newborn. It was, and that was not just men, it was animals. Of course, they didn't just say men, I don't think, in the answer. They just said newborn males. Did they say men in there? Just newborn males, right?
Right.
So that could apply to animals too. But again, they're wrong on that, the males. I'm going to give them half credit on that. So it would be minus 10 instead of minus 20. Okay? Any other questions? Subtract the number wrong from 100 then, and that'll give them their percentage grade, and then write it down at the top. So if they missed one question, it's 100 minus 20 equals 80%. And circle the percentage score up the top and then return it to the owner, if you will. Well, and then if you'll please pass the papers to the front of the row, we'll collect them. I'm not doing this to be mean, believe it or not. I'm doing it because I want you to learn the material. And I know how easy to say it is to say, well, you know, reading assignment, 5 pages, I just, you know, don't have time to do it, which of course isn't true. Anybody's got time to read 5 pages in a whole week. But I know that it's easy to kind of let that stuff slide and then you don't learn the material. This way, it kind of requires you to know it. Either you know it or you don't know it. And you might want to be prepared in the future. I may pop a pop quiz on you in the future on your reading assignments as well, instead of having you just turn in a piece of paper saying, yes, I read it, or no, I didn't read it. Yes?
Should we read it more than once? That's how I read it. I didn't remember
half. Well, might be a good idea, especially if it's just a short, brief little section, 4 or 5 pages, why? Might be good to... The main thing is understand it. Don't just, you know, clock yourself and how quick can I get through this material reading it, but read it for comprehension, read it for understanding, and then you'll be in good shape. Yes? Yes. Yes, but the major difference on a test, a written test, would be that almost always it would be a multiple choice question. So that it would be, how many years was Israel in Egypt? A, you know, 50, B, 100, C, 200, D, 430, E, 800, and then you'd have to circle the right one. And so that's almost always it'll be a multiple choice question on a test or a matching question. Generally, no short answer, no essay, no fill in the blank, either multiple choice or check all that apply or matching type questions. And I don't try to give a lot of questions on real technical areas like dates and things like that, but I do believe that if you're going to know Bible history, if you're going to know Old Testament history, there are a few dates and a few figures, a few mathematical figures that you should know, because we're talking about a period of time, and if you don't have any concept in your mind about how long they were here, or when this happened, or how early that happened, or how long this took, then you don't really know the history, because it's more than just knowing the events. It's more than just knowing the people, but it's also knowing when. And even though we must deal in approximate figures when you get back that far in history, yet when you've read and been given in class an exact figure, then that would be the figure that we'll deal with. And I wouldn't quibble with somebody as to whether, you know, in some cases, whether it was 2 or 3 years difference, like the silent year period, for example, 350 years. It might have been 400. It might have been 300. But I was testing you on the reading assignment, which said 350, and that's the only reason why I'm asking you to give 350 back, okay? And so if you can have in your idea of mind now, well, about 350 years silent there between Genesis and Exodus, they were in Egypt, they were increasing, they were prospering, they were growing into a nation, then you've got a concept in your mind about history that'll help you to understand it better. So that's what we're doing there. But in a course like this, which is a background course, it's not a you know, what they call a glory course, it's a background course, we want you to learn this history. We want you to know it. We want you to know what happened and when it happened and why it happened and so forth. And we don't have a lot of time to give you know, lots of typology and spiritual truths and applications, although we do give some of the main ones. But the main thing is history. That's what this is, a survey of Old Testament history. And so I really want you to know it. I want you to read this book and understand it. I want you to follow the lectures closely, take good notes, and then it'll pay off dividends, I'll guarantee you. When you get out into the ministry, or even before, as you're around here and so forth, when statements are made and things are said, rarely do people have the time to stop and qualify every statement and explain all the historical background for things they state. And if you don't know the history, these things will just fly right by you and you won't understand some of it at least. But this way, you'll have it nailed down and you'll understand it. Yes? There are books written on ancient history that have gleaned from histories written other than what's in the Bible. There isn't a whole lot available, but there are some. And for a person interested, you could check the Old Testament History section in the Bible College Library, which is over somewhere near that big Xerox copy machine. There's a middle row in there, and it says Old Testament History. And we've got books in there that give you Bible history plus outside history, and they mention where it's from outside and where it's from in the Bible. And and they get it from different records. Some of the kings kept court histories and court records. The kings of Assyria, the pharaohs in Egypt, they kept certain records, and we have some of those that have come down to us today. And so some of that does help to fill in some of the gaps in the Bible history. But there are still some gaps left even after everything's put together. Plus, some of the outside historical information is kind of shaky in some instances. You can't be real certain whether they were telling the truth or not, or whether they were exaggerating as to certain dates or certain figures and so on. And so the Bible history is the only one that you can say dogmatically every statement in here is obviously historically accurate and true. When you get to outside history, then you've got to be a lot more careful in weighing in it. It should always be weighed in the light of Bible history rather than weighing Bible history in the light of the outside history. Okay? Now, we're talking about Jacob in the book of Genesis, chapter 30. So, if you'd like to turn there, we'll continue. Yes?
Uh-huh.
It does say that God hardened Pharaoh's heart several times, and it does say several times that Pharaoh hardened his own heart. And I think in general his explanation was pretty safe to follow. The only question gets down to in what sense did God harden Pharaoh's heart? And I tend to think that it was not so much God coming down and somehow supernaturally working in his heart to make him hard towards the Lord, but that the Lord brought Pharaoh to a crossroads of decision by saying, "Let my people go," and in not allowing him to say maybe, it had to be a yes or a no. And he had to make a decision at that point in time. And God foreknew what he would say, of course, but he still presented it with him, and he had the free will. And I believe it's in that sense that God confronted him with the situation, that God hardened his heart. He might explain it a little bit different way and might make it seem like there was actually something done, but I just don't think that God does that. I think it's more the outward circumstances that he was in that forced Pharaoh to either be for the Lord or to be against him. And he said no, and then God brought it again and gave him another plague. And the plagues were hardening his heart. Every time he would say no, God would send another plague through Moses, and that would harden his heart again. He would harden it more, and he'd say, "I'm not going to do it." And so the Lord would come again, "Let my people go." And he'd say no, and another plague would come. And that was hardening his heart all along. But he would, when it says he hardened his own heart, that showed what he was actually doing in his heart. He was saying, I'm not going to let these people go. My pride is at stake. My kingdom, my Pharaoh image is king and so forth over Egypt. And these people are just slaves, and we have gods, and they have a god. And I'm not going to let them go. And that was what he did. Yes? I doubt it, but because of the intensity, because of the degree, because of the order in which they came, because they always came at the commandment of Moses and left at the commandment of Moses, and because many of them did not come upon the Israelites living in Goshen section of Egypt, I think they were too clearly a supernatural witness of God for Pharaoh to be able to write them off as being, well, we just have a bad crop this year, or well, we just have a disease, hoof and mouth disease or something on the cattle. I think it was too obviously supernatural for him to be able to write it off as a natural circumstance something else I was going to say. There was about the third plague that the even his magicians, his court wise men and astrologers and magicians said when they saw that plague, this is the finger of God, which was even them admitting, and that was quite an admission for them to make, because they were supposed to be the representatives of the various gods of Egypt, you know, and have the wisdom and so forth. And finally they had to admit, this is the finger of God. This is not just magic. This is not just soothsaying. This is God. And so it was clear to Pharaoh that this was the Lord, but he still hardened his heart against it, which brought even more judgment after each successive rejection on his part. Okay, I don't want to get into too many outside questions on the reading assignment. The reason why is because we're still way back here in the time of Jacob. I'd rather wait till we work ourselves up to that point in history in our lecture, and then I can open it up for a little bit more general discussion. Plus, I may answer some of your questions just in the course of the lecture. So maybe we'll go ahead and move along this time. If you've got a specific one, if you write it down, get it into me. Okay, Genesis 30. Where did we leave off? Can somebody tell me the last statement I made?
37 through 41.
Okay, the flock multiplying, Laban's flock, by supernatural action of God, caused to bring forth spotted and speckled and so forth, and therefore prospers Jacob and increases his flock. Okay, good. Now in chapter 31, Jacob finally leaves Laban. And actually, he sneaks off. He flees. He takes his two wives, Rachel and Leah, his 11 children, all of his flocks and goods, and he flees Laban, probably knowing that Laban would not willingly let him go, because Laban knew that the Lord was blessing Laban for his sake, and so Laban had a good thing. He didn't want to let him go. Plus, maybe he feared that Laban wouldn't let him take the flocks. You know, Laban, because Laban has proven himself to be a dishonest employer now, having changed his wages 10 times and everything else. So with all that in mind, a little bit of fear, he flees. Laban has turned against Jacob by this time, and Laban has been treating him hard and harshly. So it's the Lord that actually comes to Jacob and says, now's the time, return to Canaan, to your homeland. Jacob explains the situation to Rachel and Leah, his wives, tells them why he's leaving, and asks if they will be willing to come with him. Big step for them. And they agree to leave, and therefore Jacob and his family depart. But before they leave, Rachel steals these little household gods or household idols that belonged to her father Laban. And these were little statuettes that represented the deities worshipped by the family, showing that Laban was still involved in some idolatry. And these teraphim probably also were family heirlooms passed on from generation to generation in the family that showed who had possession of all the inheritance. In other words, they were like a will, last will and testament that would say, you know, you are in possession of all my goods. And so for them to take that would be, in a sense, for them to say that they had, you know, right to the goods of Laban, which now they had much of in the form of the flocks that Jacob had. So Laban, finding out that he has left and finding out that the teraphim are gone, chases Jacob. And we have a hot pursuit here. But as Laban is on the way to get Jacob, God appears to Laban in a dream. And he says, be careful how you treat Jacob. Don't be speaking harshly to him. Don't be dealing falsely with him. Just be careful what you say. Don't try to pressure him. So Laban finally catches up with Jacob, and he scolds Jacob, saying, number one, why did you leave? Secretly, I would have made a big party for you and sent you off with a farewell And that's questionable after having known what kind of person Laban is, but he's really laying it on thick here. And why did you sneak off and you took my daughters and my flocks and everything else? Well, they happen to be his wives, his flocks, so Laban's, you know, being Laban. And then he says, and why did you take my teraphim? And Laban and Jacob knows nothing about it. He doesn't know that his wife Rachel has taken these things because she's hidden them. And so Jacob feels he's totally innocent of this. And he says, what are you talking about? We didn't take them. Do you search through all the tents and everything I've got? And if you find them, the people that have stolen those, you can kill. And you can, you know, bring justice about, because we're pure. We're innocent of that. This is a false charge. And so Laban starts ransacking Jacob's camp and caravan for his idols, but he can't locate them, because Rachel hid them under this. She was sitting in her tent. She was sitting on the saddle assembly that went over her camel, and she didn't get up from that, and it was hidden underneath that. So Laban, fortunately for Jacob and fortunately for Rachel, never found him. And so he has to pretty much let that go. And then at the end of this chapter, we see that Laban and Jacob enter into a covenant. It's a covenant of peace. A covenant of peace whereby they promise that they will not pass over this boundary to do one another harm. Jacob won't come from Canaan and pass over that boundary into Mesopotamia to hurt Laban, and vice versa. And they seal it with a sacred meal together, and they set up a boundary marker as a witness of that covenant of peace. And then Laban takes his leave of Jacob. And that's pretty much the last we see of Laban. Here, Romans 12:18 comes into view. As much as is possible, or as much as lieth within you, be at peace with all men. And so at least he left on peaceable terms with Laban, even though Laban had been the one that had been wrong. It kind of brings up a question of Rachel's spirituality, doesn't it, as to why she's taking these. But like I say, there seems to be some evidence to support the contention that it was more than just an idolatrous thing representing their gods, but that it also stood for the inheritance, and that she was saying that rightfully the inheritance belonged to her sons rather than Laban's sons, because Jacob's been faithful and God has prospered him and given him the flocks and so forth, and that may be why she took it, and not just for idolatry purposes, although that may have been involved in it as well. And we'll see that later Jacob finds out and he commands him to put all these gods away. Yes. Verse 30 what?
35.
In chapter 31?
Yeah. The reason why she wouldn't get out?
Well, this is a euphemistic way of saying that she was in her period, her menstrual period. Okay, that's the excuse, and it may have been true, but that's the excuse that she gave to her father Laban for not rising up off the saddle so that he could look under it, because he was ransacking everything, probably going through trying to find it. So she lied. Well, either she lied and it wasn't that time, or she told the truth, but maybe she could have really gotten up if she'd wanted to. But she said, you know how, you know, a little bit weak and sick and so forth feeling, so I'll just stay here. And so, fortunately, he didn't press her on the issue, and he went on ahead out of the tent, and he never found it. Doesn't say a whole lot for, you know, for Rachel's spirituality, but I believe that as Rachel and Leah continue to live with Jacob, they would learn less and less the ways of their father Laban and his idolatry, and more the ways of their husband Jacob and the ways of the God of Jacob. Yes. I think the indications are, you don't see all that much of her, but from the little that we do see, there seems to be a definite increase in her love for the Lord, and as evidenced by when she gives birth to her son Benjamin and so forth, and just various other indications and descriptions of her in the Scripture would seem to show that she did come to have a love for the Lord, and I believe she was in the covenant of God. Okay? Chapter 32, Jacob and Esau. So Jacob continues his journey. By the way, here's where he is now. He has left the area of Haran way up here in Mesopotamia, and he has come down here south toward Canaan's land here. But before he's able to cross over Jordan and get into Canaan's land proper, Laban's men catch up with him when he's in Gilead, which is east of the Jordan River. On this expanded map, he's come down here from the north, and he's somewhere in this area here, east of the Jordan River in Transjordan or Gilead area. And this is where Laban catches up with him. And then Laban leaves after it's over. And Jacob continues on his way. And we're going to see that Esau is going to come up. And there's going to be a confrontation between Jacob and his older brother, Esau. But on his return trip to his homeland, he sees a vision from the Lord. And in this vision, the Lord comforts him and lets him know that he is with Jacob and that he will protect him. And the word Mahanaim is used there. Jacob calls that place where he saw the vision Mahanaim, which means two camps or two companies. Probably referring to, he saw a host of angels, it says. And so now he knew God was with him. He didn't have to fear. The Lord was going to lead him and guide him back to his land, and he didn't have to fear Esau, who he heard was on the way to meet him. And so there was the camp of God and his camp, Mahanaim, two camps. Saw the Lord's angels. So then he hears that Esau is on the way up here from Edom, south of the Dead Sea, up here to meet Jacob. And he happens to be coming with 400 men. Now, usually, you wouldn't need 400 men with you just for a visit to somebody. You know, generally, if you're coming with 400 men, they're probably armed, and it probably is an indication of a military objective. And remember how Esau wanted to slay Jacob originally. That's why he left Mesopotamia 20 years, Canaan 20 years earlier. And now he's returning, and he's a little bit afraid. You know, his knees are knocking a little bit. I mean, he's believing the Lord. God has just showed him that vision, but still, in the natural, you think about it. Here you've got all your women and children and everything in your flocks, and you're just kind of slowly moving along. And here comes Esau, and he knows what kind of man Esau was, with 400 men. And so he begins to pray to the Lord here for protection and for deliverance, because he's afraid Esau may have held a grudge all this time, and may be coming up, you know, to wipe out Jacob and his whole camp. You know, people hold grudges out long? They do. I've heard of people holding grudges their entire life against, you know, maybe an ex-wife or something. They got a divorce and bitter breakup and so forth in the family, and they'll hold a grudge against that person, or against their parents because their parents wronged them, or they felt their parents wronged them, or against children or friends or whatever. People can hold things in their hearts for an amazingly long period of time. So, Jacob figures, I'm going to do everything I can to placate Esau. In other words, to make him feel good about me. So, he sends gifts and flocks of gifts to Esau ahead of his camp. So that when Esau comes, he'll meet a flock and he'll say, "What's this?" And the messenger will say, "A gift from your servant Jacob." And then he'll meet another flock. "What's this?" Another gift from Jacob. And he's giving him all these gifts of animals and flocks. Showing his wealth, showing how God has blessed him, showing his strength, but also to placate Esau and to try to avert any anger that he might have. And then, before Jacob and his own little retinue now with his wives and children actually come to meet Esau, there's still some distance between the two, night falls. And he falls asleep, and then he finds himself, and he wakes up. And it's not a dream this time, but he wakes up and he finds himself wrestling with a man. And this man turns out to be an angel. And it turns out to be not only an angel, but the angel of Yahweh. It's a manifestation of God. And it was a real manifestation. This scripture is not saying that there was no man and that Jacob was just praying and that God is describing it under the analogy of wrestling. No, no. He was actually wrestling with this man, this manifestation of God. But it typifies prayer. And he was praying, as we see in Hosea. It mentions that he was praying and begging and beseeching and crying all the time he was wrestling. So and so he's wrestling with this man, but he's not able to overcome him. He's not able to, you know, to pin him. And that means that our flesh can never prevail before the Lord. It's not by the works of flesh that salvation comes to us, but it's the gift of God, the grace of God. But on the other hand, he didn't let go. So he was kind of, in the middle there. He couldn't prevail over the angel, but the angel couldn't prevail over him. Jacob wouldn't let go. He just grabbed on and hung on. And that's what we do. We need to hang on to the Lord. We can't prevail in our own flesh, but we can hang on in prayer and beseech God and believe Him. And so the angel puts Jacob's thigh out of joint. And he could have done this at the beginning, but he's going to let Jacob wrestle a little bit and try to prove that he couldn't do it in himself. And then the angel says, "Let me go." And Jacob says, "I won't let you go except you bless me," showing that Jacob understood what was going on. He knew that it wasn't just some robber coming into the camp trying to wrestle him and get his goods away. He knew that this was a manifestation of God. He had talked with the Lord before. He'd seen that staircase into heaven and seen the Lord and other manifestations of God. And he knew that this meant something. Because he had this great calamity ahead of him, or possible calamity with Esau. And you know how it's often in a time of trial and testing in our life that the Lord comes to us, and that we need to wrestle with Him, as it were. We need to prevail in prayer. And this is what Jacob was doing. So he says, "I will not let you go except you bless me." And so finally he blesses him there at that place. He receives the blessing of the Lord. He prevails with the Lord in the situation. And so he lets the angel go. And then God comes and changes his name from Jacob to Israel. Finally, there's been a crisis experience in his life. And God has taught him something, and he's hung on to God, and no longer is he the old heel catcher, the old supplanter or deceiver. Now he's the prince with God, Israel. Prince with God, or prevailed with God. Either one is a possible translation of that. Both are true. So he typifies those who are not satisfied until they get the very best from God. Spiritual victory in a time of trial. And then after that it says the sun rose, and Jacob halted on his thigh. And so apparently he had a physical limp for the rest of his life as a result of that divine wrestling match. But that would be a remembrance for him for the rest of his life, that he had had an experience with the Lord. Just like our newborn spirits and being filled with the Holy Spirit is a reminder to us for the rest of our life that we have had an experience with God and that we are walking with God, and our walk is not the same as a result. So that's a highlight in his life, where he wrestles with the angel, prevails, he's blessed, his name is changed from Jacob to Israel at that time. And it's interesting to note that it was that evening, it was the evening before the day when he was going to meet Esau, and with great fear and trembling, wondering what was going to happen. Some of the darkest hours in our lives, in other words, when we feel that we are in the worst place and the worst pressure is upon us, can be some of the brightest pages in our spiritual history, because that gives us opportunity to lean upon the Lord and depend upon God like we would perhaps not otherwise do if we felt self-sufficient and contented in ourselves. And so that's something you need to remember. Okay, chapter 33, Jacob and Esau are reconciled. Jacob finally meets Esau, and Esau, instead of coming with a sword, comes and hugs him, and they hug each other, and they weep there, and they have a joyful reconciliation. And so Esau has now been reconciled to Jacob. And this typifies the fact that we can overcome the flesh nature through the power of the Spirit, through the power of Jesus. We can overcome that flesh that we war with. Also, Jacob can typify Christ here, who grew in favor with God and man, it says in Luke 2:52. And it says, when a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. Proverbs 16:7. So Jacob's fears were all for nothing, in a sense, because God, I believe, had showed him that vision of the host of angels, because he knew he was going to find out that Esau was on the way to meet him, and he did that purposely to put something in his heart that he could hold on to comfort him so that he wouldn't have to fear. Well, he still went ahead and did fear, even though he trusted the Lord, but I don't think he really had to fear. I think God was going to protect him. He didn't have to worry about Esau, but he did, but God brought him through it, and there's a reconciliation there. Now, then in the end of chapter 33, Esau returns back to his own nation of Edom, south of the Dead Sea, and Jacob finally crosses over the Jordan River and comes to a place called Shechem, right here, just about in the middle of Canaan's land. So now he's back in his homeland. He's not home where Dad lives, Isaac, down in Beersheba or Hebron, but he's up in the north part now, and he's staying there for a certain period of time. And during that period of time, he lives near the city of Shechem, which is inhabited by a tribe of people called the Hivites, H-I-V-I-T-E-S. And the prince of these Hivites is named Hamor. So he's the kind of the prince of this city, or the king or the head of the city, and he's got a son named Shechem. So he named the city probably after his son, or vice versa. And this man Shechem, and remember that Jacob had a daughter, Dinah. Well, Dinah goes out to visit the daughters of the city. She's probably a teenager, and she's going out to visit these gals that are her age. And it's a mistake, because they happen to be ungodly. But as a result, this man Shechem sees Dinah, her beauty, and he falls in love with her, and he rapes her. Now, whether it was any consent on her part or not, we're not told. It may have been totally forcible rape, or it may have been what you call statutory rape, meaning that she actually consented, but she was, you know, young, underage, and so it was is still his fault for seducing her. We're not told exactly what the circumstances were. But the fact remains that what he did obviously was wrong. But really, Jacob made the mistake by living in close to the heathen and allowing his daughter to go visit with him and fellowship with him and so forth, and not having an escort with her and overseeing her spiritual life a little more closely than he did. And as a result, to make a long story short, Simeon and Levi, two of Jacob's sons, find out about this dastardly deed that Shechem has committed. And by the way, Shechem gets his father to come to Jacob and ask for the hand of Dinah in marriage, because he actually does love the girl. He didn't just love her and leave her, but he actually fell in love with her and wanted to marry her. And Jacob's sons find out about it, and they come up with a real deceitful plot here, and they're able, by means of that plot, to come into the city of Shechem with the sword and to slay this whole tribe of Hivites. Hamor, his son Shechem, who had done this, and all the other men were slain by Simeon and Levi by the sword. A very cruel thing and a very wrong way of dealing with this situation, not with the wisdom of God at all. But again, part of the blame has to go to Jacob, because he kind of stepped out of the picture and he kind of left it up to his sons to decide what to do. And as a result, like fighting fire with fire. You know, Jesus said, don't return evil for evil, but good for evil. And as a result, Simeon and Levi, many, many years later, when Jacob was on his deathbed pronouncing the final blessings upon his 12 sons, he pronounced a cursing upon Simeon and Levi for this cruel deed that they had committed in killing all these men. We see this in chapter 49 and verse 5. Yes?
Wasn't that kind of like a righteous indignation, though? Did they do it for a right cause?
Well, first of all, something should have been done for justice to be meted out. But the question is, was it right to go and slay a whole city of people just because of what one man did? And it seems to be more of a pride thing than anything else. Their pride was hurt. You know, it was their daughter, and folly was wrought in Israel. I mean, their sister that had been defiled. She would have been their full sister of Simeon and Levi. And it's wrong, as we see from what Jacob says later on, as I say, on his deathbed. Something should have been done. And I believe if Jacob could have had the wisdom of the Lord to know what could have been done in order to rectify the matter, but he kind of backed out and left and took and kind of gave up his authority in the situation. And what they did was cruel. They even took away the flocks and the women and killed all the men, and they just went way, way over what should have been done. Yes?
These people, this tribe probably wasn't quite like the deal that Samson slew
us. Well, see, there's no indication that God commanded them to do this. In fact, it's pretty clear that he didn't. Whereas in the case of the Philistines and the others, it was by commandment of the Lord that this was brought, and therefore it was really just the judgment of God upon them through a man. If he can bring judgment through a volcano or earth opening up or plagues, he can bring judgment through men as well. But in this case, there was no indication that God led them to do this at all. This was just going forth in cruelty. That's what Jacob calls it in his cursing of them, in their cruelty, in their wrath. It was just a hot, you know, flash of anger and wrath, and they went in and slew the whole city. And they also put Jacob and his whole family in jeopardy, because now all the other Canaanite tribes would hear about the cruelty they've done, and so they've ruined their witness for the Lord. See, they ruined their witness, plus they put themselves in actual physical danger, because they're way outnumbered by the other Canaanite tribes. And when the Canaanite tribes see how aggressive they are, Jacob had reason to fear and think that, well, now the others are going to come in and slay us because of this cruel thing we've done. So there were several reasons why what they did was wrong. Yes?
Isn't it kind of strange that God would have the tribe of Levi set apart for
Yes, but this is a much later time that this happens. This is during the time of Moses that this happened. But it's interesting to note that at Mount Sinai, when the law was given and Moses came down with the tables of the law and he saw the people in sin worshiping the golden calf, that he threw the tables down and broke them, and he began to give them a, you know, a real rebuke in the Spirit of the Lord. And he said, all that are on the Lord's side, come over here. And it was the tribe of Levi. They came over to his side, and it says, every man took his sword, and by the commandment of the Lord, they went through the nation, the land, and started slaying thousands of people. And the indications in the context seem to be that they were led by the Lord and who they slew, probably the perpetrators, the main instigators of this apostasy, of this idolatry, were the ones slain. So then you see that that righteous indignation was channeled in a positive way, or that they seem to be a very zealous tribe. But if it's done in the flesh, and if it's done through a personal vendetta, rather than through the leading of God and God's indignation, then it's wrong. So there seems to be a real zealousness there that was able to be rightfully channeled at this time, and as a result, he did separate them aside for the work of the ministry. Okay, yes. Hi, Vice. Well, the question is, does that pronouncement of Jacob apply only to Levi? And the answer is it doesn't. Those pronouncements in Genesis 49, which we'll see when we get there, apply to all the tribes that came from those men and not just the men. So there was application to it. But the point I'm making is it does not negate the fact that God could still pick them out for the ministry. Okay, one more, then we'll have to move on. Probably they took their servants with them. In fact, it mentions their servants, and it mentions some of the other brothers that went in to help them to get the spoil out. So Jacob had a pretty large household. If you'll recall, when Abraham took some of his household to rescue Lot from those kings of the east, he had something like 380 men. So these rich Hebrew princes here, so to speak, had rather large households of servants and helpers and maybe armed men. And most probably, first of all, they had the element of surprise, which can really help in battle. Second of all, these men had just been circumcised, and it was the third day after they were circumcised. They were very sore and inflamed and swollen and so forth. They could hardly move. So they had them physically incapacitated. And then third of all, they most probably had servants with them, and they were able to go in and slay the people in the city. Which city? It doesn't say how big it is, how many people were involved. Okay, let's move on to chapter 35. In chapter 35, Jacob revisits the city of, or the place of Bethel. If you recall, before he left Canaan, he stopped at Luz, and that's where he had that vision of the staircase into heaven, remember, and the Lord, and he promised the Lord that he'd come return to that place after he came back from Mesopotamia, and if the Lord will bring me back, I will give him a tithe of all my goods, and so on and so forth, and he called the place Bethel, house of God. Well, now he's back to Bethel, which is right here, south of where he was in Shechem. He started out in Shechem. Now he's moved south to Bethel. And he rededicates his life to the Lord. And it's at this point that he tells his whole company to get rid of any idols that they've got. Put away these idols, put away these strange gods. See, Jacob had nothing to do with them himself, but you know, you got a large group of people here. You don't know all what's going on. He's probably heard about Rachel by now and the teraphim, that she does in fact have them. And he said, put away these gods and let's serve the Lord alone. And so they do that, and Jacob and God renew that covenant that God had made to Abraham, that God had reaffirmed to Isaac, he now reaffirms to Jacob. And he reaffirms his name change to Israel. He repeats that. Also in chapter 35, we see that Rachel, who is pregnant, bears her second son. Now she had already borne her first son, Joseph, that we looked at earlier when they were in Mesopotamia. And now she bears Benjamin, but she dies in childbirth with him. He's born, but then Rachel dies. And so she names him Ben-Oni, son of my sorrow, Ben-Oni. But Jacob changes his name and says, no, his name shall be Benjamin, son of my right hand. And the right hand speaks of a position of honor, a position of authority. And so now the 12th and last son of Jacob is born. All the first 11 were born back in Mesopotamia when he was working for Laban. And now the 12th Benjamin is born here between Bethel and Bethlehem as they're moving along south toward Hebron, where old Isaac was still alive. The Benjamin can typify the man-child company born at the end of time. 12th son, as it were. Long after the first sons, the apostolic church. Benjamin can also typify the tribulation saints, because Benjamin was born in sorrow, and the woman died after he was born, the church being persecuted and dying in the tribulation after the birth of the man-child. Then, in the end of chapter 35, we see that Jacob returns to Isaac down in Hebron, which is down here. So first he came from Haran, way up here, down to Gilead, right in this area. He crossed over, forded the Jordan River, came to Shechem, then to Bethel. Then between Bethel and Bethlehem, Rachel died in childbirth with Benjamin. And now he's come on down south to Hebron, where Isaac, his beloved father, was still alive. And he has a reunion with Isaac. And Isaac's death is recorded also at this place. And then a list of Jacob's sons is given here. And Isaac dies at the age of 180 years old. And Jacob and Esau together bury him, showing again that this apparently was a genuine reconciliation between Jacob and Esau, since they're both together again to bury their father Isaac. Okay, that's our last bell. No reading assignment for Monday, but when we come back Monday, we'll pick up with the offspring of Esau, then the offspring of Jacob, and we'll continue on in our story. Shechem to Bethel, and then between Bethel and Bethlehem, Rachel died in childbirth with Benjamin, and then he came to Hebron, where Isaac was.
He wasn't returning. That was his first time there.
Well, he may have made little trips down while all the time he was up in Shechem earlier. We're not told, but he is returning to live in Hebron now. And that's where he had grown up as a boy.
Okay. Yes. I stayed for a little more than half because I had an appointment there. I was marked down. So can I still make a return? Turn up the notes.
You stayed for half, but you were marked down.
A little more than half. That was marked down.
Yeah. Was it the first half that you stayed for?
Yeah. And I missed the roll.
You missed the roll book.
Yeah.
Have you made the tape up?
No, so I was wondering if I can still do that.
Yeah, when you make the tape up, we'll give you credit.
Okay.
Make sure you do it within the seven-day time limit, so we can give you credit for it. That's all right then. Don't worry about it. It won't be marked against you, and you won't be given credit for it. It just won't be figured into your grade. Okay? That's what we're doing with anybody that was outside of class and didn't get it. Who's got my roll book?
Yeah. How come they had just been circumcised? The whole town, city had been circumcised?
Yeah, when you read the account, you'll see that was the whole trickery thing on the part of Simeon and Levi. They said, we can't let...